One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
What is happening out there, y'all? And thanks again so much for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, us just trudging through it together, mi amigo, Big Fizzy.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skeleton Studios with Cam. Is speaking much clearer than he was a week ago.
Man, it's nice.
He's gotten rid of that tooth, folks. He just came back from surgery. Cam, tell the folks out there how your surgery went.
Dude, this was the best. Now, I've told you before, it didn't work out for me. The time I had my wisdom teeth removed, like two of them years and years ago, was the worst experience ever, right? And I hated going. I don't mind going to the dentist at all. I just hate getting massive dental work done, right?
Sure.
I'm just not a fan of that. I don't mind any of that other stuff. This, I'm not a fan of. This place is awesome. The people there are awesome. Everything was great. You talk about no troubles. Instantly no trouble. Like, every bit of it. Recovery's been amazing. I finally feel good. It's legitimately been like 90 days since I've felt this good. And then sure enough, now all this stuff blows in and now I got allergies. I've been sneezing my stupid head off.
Is it true when they did x-rays that you have a lineage to giants, that you have double rows of teeth?
Is that, I do. Is that what I mean? Yeah. I have like three rows. I look like like on Coneheads when Beldar opens his mouth.
Yeah.
With all the rows of teeth.
Now, I know that after your surgery, you were given some pretty heavy duty painkillers, right?
Yes.
Some meds to relieve the pain. So I don't want you to go and think that while you were on those pain meds that you somehow hallucinated some of the news reports. But it is true that the United States military has shot down four UFOs.
It's funny that you say that because
in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, when I was kind of tripped out, I was listening to some of that stuff because there's a couple of days there, you know, when you come out of anesthesia, you do all that. Like, you feel like you've been time traveling to start right? Nothing's right. So the next, like, the next 2 days was a little hazy for me. So, yeah, this is going to fall right in there. I'm ready to hear the rest of this. Now, I know.
Right? Like, what is going on? Now, it started. The first one was on February 4th, where a Chinese spy balloon was shot down.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that this balloon entered
alleged
Alaska. No, there's video. You can watch videos.
No. It's an alleged Chinese spy balloon.
Well, true. Right. They say that it entered Alaskan airspace on January 28th, and it drifted from Idaho southeast to the Carolinas, before it was shot down. They said the thing was flying at an altitude of 60,000 to 65,000 feet. But my question is, so they watched it drift from Alaska all the way to South Carolina without doing anything till it got to South Carolina. Why?
I'm not that
Why did they wait that long?
It's a balloon, man.
And then on February 10th, they shot down a UFO off the coast of Alaska. And they said that this thing, this was a White House official that claimed it was around the size of a car. It was kind of octagonal shaped. And the pilots that shot it down did not see any means of propulsion. Meaning looking at it with their FLIR pods and stuff like that. They didn't see any thrust, no propellers, no jet. So what does that mean?
So where did it go? Did it just explode?
They shot it down and they said that the water underneath was frozen at the time. They're going to try to send out some recovery teams to pick it up. But they're not really talking about what it was. And if that wasn't enough, then another one they shot down on February 11th, which was the next day. They shot this thing down over the Yukon Territory up there in Canada. And again, they don't really give a good description of what the object was, but they said it wasn't a balloon. And then finally, on February 12th, the next day, they shot one down over the Great Lakes, over Lake Huron. And they said that the thing was flying about 20,000 square feet, and they shot it down.
Wait, wait, wait. 20,000 foot up.
Yes, 20,000 feet up. Yeah. And the debris fell into the lake, and then they're going to send out some crews to try to see if they can pick up the debris. Now,
it seems odd to me that they shot it over the lake knowing like it's going to fall in the lake. Like you're going to shoot stuff over where people live.
Everything about it.
Right? Like you're going to shoot down another plane or another aircraft over an area where people possibly live.
Well, I mean, it was over the lake, and then the other one was up in Yukon territory. But, you know, South Carolina, they did right off the coast. Every time they've done it, it's been over an area where people aren't there. You're
and
right.
Allegedly no recovery.
Not yet. They're trying to recover. My biggest question is this as a distraction from something else that we're supposed to be watching? Because it seems awfully odd to me that they're saying that the first one was a balloon. Of course, you can watch videos of that. But the other ones, there's no videos that I've seen of what they are. But they're saying it's not balloons, but they don't know what it is.
Well, and one, because you had told me about this, because we were laughing one evening about it, because Kyle and I will be talking at midnight about crazy stuff. I'll know it's madness because I'll get text messages or I'll send him one of Hawaii being scanned.
Yeah, the green lasers. I've seen that.
Yeah. Well, then I saw a thing where they're saying that China has now shot down some sort of spy craft.
Yeah. Well, and
so there's something was showing itself over China as well.
So are you more scared if these are in fact some kind of drones that China is using, or are you more scared if it's aliens from another planet?
I'm more worried about it being aliens from another planet, honestly, than I am China.
I am too.
I'm just not really that afraid of that. You know what I'm saying?
Maybe.
Like, I'm more worried that we're going to shoot down something that was possibly trying to be helpful.
But then again, I'm not worried because obviously we're able to shoot them down. So maybe we've overestimated how advanced, I mean.
Or maybe, no, maybe they put them out there to get shot down so we get really full of ourselves.
Yeah, that's true.
You never underestimate anybody.
Well, there's a guy
named. If that's one thing jiu-jitsu has taught me 100,000%, you never take anyone for granted.
Yeah, but you're talking about anyone. You're talking about people.
Well, I'm still saying aliens. Well, then if they're smart enough to fly here, they're probably smart enough to be able to know a little tactics to be like, you know what we're going to do?
Maybe they're really good at learning how to fly across interstellar distances, but they're not very good at fighting. Maybe it's like not even a concept to them.
Well, it's going to be a concept. They keep messing around down here.
Well,
it's already a concept, right?
There's a guy named Mike Dumont, and he's
human beings shoot first and ask questions third.
Yeah, this guy is a retired vice admiral who is deputy commander of the Northern Command and vice commander of NORAD.
It's funny, I'm a dice admiral.
This is what he says. He says, one is that these have been going on before in the past, and we haven't detected them. There have been detections where our radars have picked up various phenomena. We haven't been able to clearly define what it was that they detected because, quite frankly, the equipment is not that refined. It cannot discern down to an exquisite level of detail what an anomaly in the air might be. And then the other thing is occasionally we will pick up weather phenomenon, which will indicate, you know, that there's a presence of something, maybe a balloon or an aircraft. And it turns out to be a weather anomaly just in the atmosphere. And again, some of this could be corrected with newer technologies. So that doesn't make me feel any better. So now you're saying our radar isn't that good?
That's kind of what I'm hearing.
I'm not buying it.
It's not good at high altitude. Is that kind of what I'm picking up?
I'm not buying it.
And I'm not
also,
either.
Why would China send over these stupid drones or
because we don't expect them.
But they already have satellites.
Well, they didn't have them at 60,000 feet when they sent this balloon over. Maybe they're a big fan of the Carolinas.
Much higher than that. It doesn't make sense.
That's why this gets closer. They can take better pictures. You see, you got to come on, man. You've used a camera. You just got to close in on.
Yeah,
maybe they were trying to find some good like microbreweries along the way. There's a bunch up in the Carolinas, man. You hover that thing over Asheville, you're going to get your mind blown, China.
I'm not buying it.
So what do you think it is? Do you believe the China story? Or do you think, let me run this, do you think that it started out like that? Oh, it's a weather balloon from China. And then all of a sudden now these UFOs showed up.
Yeah,
is it just kind of a coincidence they're together? Or is it a coincidence that since we don't know, we're thinking they're in air quotes UFOs or UAPs or whatever, it really is Chinese stuff
that
they've shot down?
I think it's a distraction.
I feel like it's a big distraction, yes.
Yeah, I don't think this is real. I don't know, but it is very interesting. Now, before, you were talking about the meds you were on.
Yeah.
That you thought of, you could have been possibly involved in a time slip or something like that. We had a listener write into the show with a very unusual story. Check this out. It says, "Hey, guys, I keep meaning to tell someone about this unusual string of occurrences that happened to me a while back. It's been a few years, but I think it was around 2016. I was working in a civilian records management position at a new facility being constructed on a military base in the Appalachian area. I needed some basic security clearance for this position, and the project involved BSL, which stands for Biosafety Level 4 Laboratories. Now, these lands were being constructed at the time, so there were no biological agents present, so that was good. But there was very often systems tests and fire alarm tests, etc. One day, I think it was a Wednesday, around 11 a.m., the fire alarm went off. There had been no notice about a test, so everyone evacuated while we waited to find out what was going on. Now, after a bit, they cleared the alarm and we went back in. They had no explanation for this false alarm. When we came back in, I noticed my watch was an hour fast compared to the time on my phone. Later, one of the crew and I noted that the battery-operated analog clock in the office was also an hour fast compared to our phones. We reset it and went about the day. When I got off work, I picked up my son, and he said that he had a fire alarm at school too, but that it hadn't been a drill, so the fire department came out and found nothing. I asked when it was, and he said it was around 11:30 a.m. When we got home, I noticed that the clocks on the stove were an hour behind compared to the time on my phone and my watch. I reset them all, and it seemed odd that all of these clocks were running fast and slowed compared to the time on the phones and the computers, which are all linked to a central satellite. The whole thing was just weird. Did I experience a time slip? AL. So, it's kind of, she's working this secret laboratory for the military. Some kind of a fire alarm goes off and it like distorts time, like they jumped in time. Or at least that's what it seems like.
Yeah, that's what it seems like.
Makes me think of Stranger Things, right? At like the facility when they're testing stuff. Remember when they opened up that portal?
Yeah.
Wonder if stuff is like that's going on. You know, like you mentioned before on the show, there's a lot of theories about when CERN was running those tests, that they somehow tore a hole in time, and that's when the Mandela effect.
They fired it up, yeah.
All these things happened. I don't know. Very interesting story.
Because it feels like a crazy alternate timeline sometimes, right?
Yeah,
like,
maybe.
You're like, what's going on? I'm sitting here right now listening to that, trying to think of a way that, like, how would you... That's just too many coincidences, right?
I would think so.
How would it be to where your watch was faster than your phone and you get home? Now, I understand maybe you had a power outage there and it was all flashing. But if it's not flashing and it, you know, because like lots of them, the old schools, as they flash, they'll keep time from 12, right? But they flash until you click it. So you can kind of get a rough idea of what time, you know, however many hours has been since the power actually went out of what time it was. But the odds of that happening and then the odds of something on your watch happening. And all of this happening at the same time that you've experienced all this other people.
And, the coworkers experienced the same thing.
And your coworkers. And then your kids talking about some weird stuff going. Man, it's too much to be a coincidence.
And you know that your like phone, like you used to have to worry about when the time changed. It does it all automatically now. Yeah. You don't have to worry about it. Like when, you know, spring forward and fall back, you had to actually remember. Now the phone does it all for you.
That is so crazy that maybe it doesn't experience the time.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about some unseen assistants, some guardian angels, some companions that help people when they're in dire need. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
What One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
On the 20th of May, 1916, Ernest Shackleton, Frank Worsley, and Tom Crean reached Stromness, a whaling station on the north coast of South Georgia. They had been walking for 36 hours, in life-threatening conditions, in an attempt to reach help for the rest of their party. Three of their crew were stuck on the south side of the island, with the remainder stranded on Elephant Island. To reach the whaling station, the three men had to cross the island's mountainous interior with just a rope and an axe in a journey that few had attempted before or since. By reaching Stromness, they managed to save all the men left from the ill-fated Imperial Transantarctic Expedition. They did not talk about it at the time, but weeks later, all three men reported an uncanny experience during their trek, a feeling that often there were four, not three, men on their journey. The fourth that accompanied them had the silent presence of a real person, someone walking with them by their side, as far as the whaling station, but no further. Shackleton was apparently deeply affected by the experience, but would say little about it in subsequent years, considering it something which can never be spoken of. Encounters with these are common in extreme survival situations. Guardian angels, guides, or even Christ-like figures have often been reported. We know them now as the Third Man, following a line in T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland. Who is the third who always walks beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look up ahead the white road, there is always another one walking beside you. Eliot had heard of Shackleton's encounter, but could not remember the precise details, meaning that the fourth man became the third. In his book, The Third Man Factor by John Geiger, he collects together a wide range of third man stories, and I highly suggest you pick it up, including accounts from mountaineers, sailors, and survivors of terrorist attacks. They all involve a strong impression of a felt presence, sometimes with a voice or a shadow-like image, but often without a clear form. Extreme physical conditions, a threat to life, and social isolation all seem to trigger the feeling of a presence, which will often feel as if it had a spiritual or guiding purpose. In the case of the third man, it is tempting to think that strong feelings of a presence act as some sort of hallucinatory defense mechanism, something that could happen to anyone, but only in very extreme scenarios. Such experiences are, however, also reported in much less dramatic circumstances. Following bereavement, for example, many people report seeing the presence of their deceased loved one,
a feeling that someone is still in the house, just upstairs, or still sitting in their favorite chair. On today's show, I'm going to be sharing with you some of these bizarre experiences. Let's begin. Extreme altitude was not a factor for the American climber, Rob Taylor, in the struggle that followed his failed attempt to ascend the breach wall of Kilimanjaro in January 1978. The mountain itself, which rises some 19,340 feet from the plains of Africa, is not a difficult ascent despite its height. Tourists, without climbing experience, can pay guides to take them up its slopes. The breach wall, though, is a little bit different. A technically demanding climb that, in the first weeks of 1978, was more challenging than usual, thanks to over 300 feet of rotten ice near the top. To the depth of a yard, the ice had the consistency of sugar. Taylor had to scrape the ice crystals away before securing his ice screws. He realized that in such conditions, a fall was a real possibility, and compensated by securing closely placed ice screws. The fall came away when the ice Taylor was holding onto collapsed. He fell into space, but was saved by his climbing ropes. He was immediately aware of a sharp pain in his left foot. He had broken his ankle when he lurched back into the ice wall following his sudden drop. The arch of his left foot was twisted grotesquely so that it touched his inner calf, and his boot began filling with blood rapidly. He struggled for control as the haze of shock threatened to envelop him. First, he had to try to get the bones of his shin and foot back in place. Climbing partner Harley Warner grabbed hold of Taylor's left boot and held firmly. Taylor pulled, and after several minutes of agony, his fibula popped into place. He then used the shaft of an ice axe as a splint. In other circumstances, this would have been a serious but manageable injury, but at 18,000 feet in elevation and 75 miles from the nearest medical help, the 23-year-old suddenly found himself in a race against infection and the possible onset of gangrene. With Warner, Taylor was forced to bivouac and then begin the hazardous and laborious descent early on January 15. Initially, Warner lowered the injured climber down the mountain, but as the steepness of the descent gave way to sloping ground, Taylor lost whatever mobility he had. Warner could not carry him far, so Taylor had to drag himself, groveling only a few meters at a time, he said, on my chest. Yet the rappel down the wall and the subsequent creep down from the glacier's edge, for all its agonizing hardship, was not the worst of Taylor's ordeal. On January 17th, Taylor was deposited on the lee side of some large boulders at the base of Kilimanjaro. He crawled into his sleeping bag and bivy sack and waited for a while. Warner went for help. Warner assured him that the rescue party would be there the following morning at the latest, and Taylor had no reason to doubt him. With the immediate danger of the descent past, he finally felt relaxed, at times even elated. But no one came the next day, and Taylor's deteriorating situation was made worse when his small butane stove ran out of fuel. He could no longer melt snow for water. Then Taylor noticed a male figure crouching fewer than 50 yards away from him. He at first thought it must be a member of this rescue party and began yelling for assistance. But there was no response. "Who are you? What do you want? Answer me," he shouted. He felt confused, then anger and frustration at the failure of the figure to respond. He was desperate for help. He was waiting for help. He was expecting help, but no help was forthcoming. Taylor began to throw rocks in the direction of the figure in order to elicit some sort of response. Some seemed to pass right through it.
He said, I could clearly make out his form. Yet, can I distinguish exact features through the snowy haze? So taut are the general lines of his body. He appears devoid of clothing, kind of like a dancer in a leotard. Taylor found it impossible to categorize the experience. My mind does not know what to do with him. But he began to accept that the figure, which sat serenely on a boulder, was simply there to keep him company. He said, hour upon hour, this companion watcher, that's what I call him, peers out at me through the curtain of snow. With darkness, he directed his headlamp in the direction of his companion and found him still acting as a silent sentinel. That night, Taylor awoke suddenly, as if an alarm had been sounded. He realized that he not only felt no pain, but his injured foot, he felt nothing at all. Pulling off his sleeping bag, he was hit by an overwhelming smell of decay. He tried to wrench the boot off his injured foot, but it would not come free. He then began hacking at it with his ice axe, before eventually finally prying the boot off. His foot was severely infected, and once freed, jets of yellow pus shot from the wounds. The foot had swollen in the boot, thus cutting off circulation, which allowed the infection to take hold. With the restoration of blood flow, he began feeling again in his ankle, foot, and toes. Taylor set about cleaning the wound the best he could. He believed that if he had not discovered the infection until later that morning, it would have been too late to save his foot. So he began to ask himself, what woke me? Was it my companion watcher? Was he sent to me as a messenger? Someone, some being, guides me on my journey. Before lying back down, Taylor cast the beam of his headlamp to look for his friend. He stared out into the darkness, searching for the presence, and he saw him again, this time much closer. 2 more days passed, and 2 more nights. Something had happened to Warner. He was not coming back. There would be no rescue team. Fever set in. Thought, reality, and the apparition all seemed to merge. His companion moved closer still, yet Taylor could not make out any of its details. He could see a brow, he could see the shape of a chin, but nothing more. He thought it odd that, despite the snowfall, there was no snow on the figure, yet it took up absolutely solid space like a stone or something else. Finally, the figure was right at the foot of the sleeping bag. At the end, Taylor felt the being was very benevolent and very positive. It was peaceful and definitely reassuring. Then, after waiting with him for days, the presence suddenly departed, and Taylor was all alone. A few minutes later, he heard his name being called. It was the rescue team. Taylor's life and foot were saved. Warner apparently had taken a different route on his hike to get help and had become lost, accounting for the long delay. Taylor later wrote of his encounter. He said, I don't often talk about my companion watcher these days. He is a creature out of place here, misunderstood. After the breach, when I first spoke of him to people, they reacted quite predictably. What an imagination, they would say. Your fever must have had you hallucinating. At first, I persisted in my stand. He was real, there in the flesh, or at least in some concrete form that I could see. Later, I left him out altogether. It was easier than trying to define or defend him to people who just simply didn't understand. Now, I know this, and I say this to you. He was there, and as real as you or I. I do not know to this day his purpose, but I sense that it was good. In May 1981, a man named Jim Wickwire, a 40-year-old Seattle attorney and a skilled climber who had already been to the summit of K2, set out to climb Mount McKinley's imposing Wickersham Wall. It is one of the largest mountain faces in the world, rising 13,780 feet from the Peters Glacier to 20,320-foot North Peak. Because of avalanche hazard, it has not been climbed since 1963. But Wickwire and a younger climber named Chris Carabrock felt it was not an insurmountable challenge. They were deposited by aircraft at the mountain's main landing site and then made their way around to the remote north side. They negotiated some tricky ice cliffs and a large crevasse at the foot of the glacier and then made their way down the Peters Glacier towards the base of Wickersham Wall. They were traveling slowly across the glacier in the middle of the afternoon on May 8th, hauling a sledge of supplies. They were roped together. Carabrock was leading when a crust of ice concealing a crevasse collapsed, sending him headlong into the opening. Wickwire, who did not see the fall, was grabbed and thrown into the air by the force of Carabrock's weight on the rope. He remembered thinking, "I'm about to die," before he and the sledge both hurtled into the crevasse and slammed on top of Carabrock, who was alive but was lodged face down between the wall of the crevasse, buried underneath his large pack, which had been compressed to half its normal width by the force of the impact. Wickwire, stunned by what had just happened, gathered himself up and shoved the sledge off of Carabrock. All Wickwire could do or see was Carabrock and his legs. He was still wearing his snowshoes. Carabrock screamed out, "I can't move! Wick, man, you gotta get me out!" Wickwire had broken his shoulder, but was able to edge himself up, using an ice hammer with his good arm to make small indentations into the ice, onto which he placed the front points of his crampons. Gradually and slowly, he was able to climb out of the crevasse. It took an hour to ascend a 25-foot shaft. He finally emerged and lay on the snow, gasping and trying to catch his breath. Wickwire immediately began to work to free Carabrock, first taking up the slack of the rope, and despite his injuries, pulling with all of his might. But his partner, he did not budge. He tried again, but could not pull Carabrock free. He realized that he would have to re-enter the crevasse. So, he tied a rope to a picket that he drove deep into the hard snow and then lowered himself in. He first tried to pull on Carabrock's pack. Then, he tried tying the rope to the pack's accessible cross straps and pulled on them. Well, that failed too. He took his ice hammer to the pack, trying to cut the material, thinking that by removing some of the items in it, he would relieve the compression that had held it fast. Nothing he could do would have any effect. After 6 grueling hours of failed attempts, interrupted by radioed pleas for help that went unanswered, both men realized that Wickwire had exhausted all options. Carabrock said, "There's nothing more you can do, Wick. You should go up." Wickwire could not believe that Carabrock was going to die and that he was utterly helpless to prevent it. When he emerged from the crevasse again, Wickwire was physically spent, but also burdened with the sadness and guilt. Lying at the edge of the opening, he pulled himself into a nylon bivouac sack. Carabrock died that night from the cold and trauma. He spent his last hours in delirium from his injuries and the bitter cold. At one point, Wickwire heard Carabrock singing what sounded like an old school song. Around 2 a.m., Wickwire heard Carabrock for the last time. Wickwire's own ordeal was not over. A scheduled rendezvous with a bush plane would not occur for another 2 weeks. Most of the supplies, including a tent, stove, and the bulk of the food, remained stuck in the crevasse. Wickwire waited for rescue, with 12 sticks of beef jerky to eat and only his bivouac sack for shelter. He later re-entered the crevasse and was able to collect more food from the sledge, but it still was not enough. Sitting beneath the soaring ice cliffs on a vast glacier, he began to suffer from dehydration. He had a water bottle and was able to melt some snow by holding it against his body. And on some days, the warmth of the sun helped. The pilot who had flown them in had promised to fly by and check on their status, and Wickwire waited for the sound of the aircraft. Several times he thought he heard light planes flying over, but they were always too far away. After 7 days, the threat of an avalanche forced him to move. In doing so, he twice nearly fell into different crevasses. Wickwire later wrote in his journal, "At times, the past week, I've almost turned to talk to someone. I had a sense that there was a second person that's here." He wondered whether this being was part of my personality disengaged from itself, or perhaps Chris's spirit, or was it just my fear and loneliness? Wickwire was not threatened by this other existence. In fact, he said it was comforting. It was reassuring to me. It was a companion, a sense of support. It was also a signal to me that I was in an extreme situation. It was kind of a confirmation of that. He decided that if he was going to survive, he had to continue moving towards the climbers who congregated on the other side of the mountain. This was his only choice. He crawled, probing the crust of the glacier with his ice axe, this way avoiding each crevasse in his path. He made steady progress, and with the crevasses behind him, he thought he was about a day away from reaching help. Then, a blizzard struck. He was forced to stop. The temperature dropped, and he was buffeted by winds up to 75 miles per hour. The snow piled up on him. Wickwire was now down to one stick of beef jerky. He craved food, but it was not only hunger that gnawed at him. He suffered episodes of unbearable loneliness. Yet, during the four-day-long storm, the strange presence returned and remained close by. Wickwire felt comforted by the sense that he was not alone, that someone was there with him. He ascended to the upper glacier, and the danger posed by the crevasses lessened. He finally made radio contact with the pilot. The plane was approaching when he reached down to pick up his pack, and one foot punched through yet another crevasse. He lunged forward to safety. It was too much. It was almost as if the glacier was determined not to allow him to escape. Wickwire sat on the ground and wept. In the end, the pilot landed nearby, and Wickwire did escape. He was 25 pounds lighter than when him and Karabakh had been dropped off only 3 weeks earlier. It's hard to imagine a more horrifying saga than that suffered by Kenneth Cook, a merchant seaman aboard a freighter, the SS Lulworth Hill, after it was torpedoed by a German U-boat on March 19, 1943, off the west coast of Africa, to the east of the Ascension Islands. The ship, bound for Britain from Cape Town, with a load of explosives, aircraft engines, rum, and sugar, had been pursued for hours by the enemy, but its end was very quick and sudden. Severed by powerful blasts, the Lulworth Hill sank in a minute and a half, allowing only 14 of her crew of 57 to reach life rafts. They were adrift in shark-infested waters, about 750 miles from any land. What followed was a saga of unremitting cruelty. From the beginning, they were, Cook wrote, a sorry-looking lot. Their faces blackened by fuel oil and their clothing torn to shreds by the explosions. From their location, they calculated that it would take 30 days before they would be rescued. One by one, the survivors, burned by the unrelenting equatorial sun, starved from only the barest of provisions and, for some, driven by thirst to drink seawater, cast off any hope of survival. They lay side by side, their bodies covered with saltwater boils, their tongues swollen, living only for the horizon. Sharks stalked them relentlessly. On the fifth day, a building chorus of despair reached a fever pitch. We had it. We'll never be picked up, nor reach land neither. That's what Cook said. But it soon trailed off, and by the eighth day, Cook observed that no one had said anything for 48 hours. Later in the second week, the noise level rose again, the situation having deteriorated so badly, the people with muttered curses, gibberish, sobbing, and moans of agony. On April 6th, after 19 days on the raft, came the first death. The mate, Basil Scowen, had spent a terrible night, raving throughout. He twice tried to get over the side, but was so weak that a single hand could restrain him. At 4 p.m., he seemed to pick up. He opened his eyes and asked for water. Cook gave him 2 ounces, holding the cup to his parched lips. The mate looked peaceful and become lucid. He said, "Tell the others that they were a good lot of men." He then smiled faintly. A few minutes later, he seemed to mumble something, and Stuart, a cabin boy, bent his head to the officer's lips to try to make out what he was saying. Suddenly, the kid screamed and began beating the mate about his head with his fist. Tears streamed down his face as he sobbed, "He's dead. I tell you, he's dead." Cook began to wonder who would be next. He said, "We were all looking at each other, quite openly now, measuring our own strength and endurance against the others. He felt like a participant in a macabre game, but there was no winners unless an extra day of torment could be considered a prize." A second death followed on the 9th of April, and a third man died on the 11th. They had been adrift now for 24 days. For Cook, the death of John Arnold, an apprentice who had passed his 18th birthday on the raft, was the hardest to accept. The boy, he wrote, actually radiated goodness and sweetness. Arnold had profound faith and, like some of the many other survivors, he liked to be left alone to pray. For some time before Arnold's death, Cook was haunted by the young man's gaunt face. He said, "I knew that face. I kept telling myself I had seen it before." Later on, he realized that John's face had, in his own mind, become one of the same, that of Christ crucified, as painted on the wall of a chapel Cook had once attended as a child. On April 12th, the 25th day, Arnold called faintly to Cook, a sea-hardened ship's carpenter, 10 years his senior. He said to Cook, "May I pray?" He then prayed for some time, before opening his eyes and looking at Cook peacefully. He then said, "I'm going to die. You see, I've been talking to God. Some of you are going to be saved, and I think that you will be among them. I want you to give a message to my mother and dad. Will you?" And Cook replied, "Of course, John. Anything, anything." He said, "Tell them I died a good Christian." Cook held him and watched, helplessly, as Arnold's life ebbed away. More deaths quickly followed, so that Cook decided death was no longer an event. He was our constant companion on the raft. They died, he felt, like flies. Some passed in horrible convulsions, retching from collapsed bellies, choking to death on swollen black tongues, screaming obscenities. Others, they died silently, their lives slipping away like rainwater running into a culvert. On April 17th, a man named Bott sprang up, crazed and exhibiting maniacal strength. He grabbed the men on either side of him and jumped overboard, taking the 2 men with him. Cook and the others on the raft tried to get their hands on the 2 victims. They succeeded in pulling 1 man back on board, but before they could reach the 2nd, a shark flashed in at him and ripped off his right leg above the knee. Bott, who was flailing about insanely, managed to keep the sharks temporarily at bay. No attempt was made to pull him in. They had no choice. Even if they could have reached him, they could never have overpowered him. They left Bott to the sharks. After a few moments of thrashing and screaming, the water around the raft became calm. On April 22nd, a man named Platt died. He was a meticulous man, cheap steward on the Lulworth Hill, and Cook thought he had steeled himself for 30 days adrift. When the 30th day passed, he simply gave up. Cook wrote in his log, which was scratched onto a piece of canvas. Eight more men passed on. The last two survivors, Cook and an able seaman named Colin Armitage, struggled to push Platten's body into the ocean. When it did finally go overboard, it immediately slid underneath the raft. The corpse remained there for 3 days, thumping and banging horribly. Finally, it slipped away. The last two men were sustained on the barest of rations, which had been stretched further by each death. But for Cook, there was something else that helped to sustain him. On April 23rd, day 36, he saw John Arnold and again heard his words that he would be saved. On the 40th day on the raft, he wrote, "I saw John Arnold's face again, and again today. His presence, as much as the water and chocolate and pemmican, kept me alive. Death was calling, however. Periods of coma had overtaken their times of awareness. On the 42nd day, Cook was watching some gulls circling around them and muttered, "If only we had wings." Then Armitage gave a whoop. Cook thought he was mad, but Armitage said, "Don't you realize these are the first birds we've seen since we've been on that raft?" They thought immediately that they must be near land. On the 43rd day, the two survivors struck a suicide bond. They determined to tie themselves together and roll into the sea where sharks would finally end the slow torture. Then Cook heard a voice. "Some of you are going to be saved." The words were so clear and distinct, he thought at first it was Armitage speaking. But Armitage was looking idly out to sea and shortly drifted back into unconsciousness. Then Cook realized who had spoken. He would later write, "Maybe it can be scientifically explained. And that voice was simply my subconscious mind telling me not to be a fool. I don't know. Perhaps so. Perhaps not. All I do know is that at the time, I was convinced that it was 18-year-old John Turney Arnold who was speaking directly to me. What is more, I could feel his invisible presence sitting there comfortingly beside me in that lonely little raft, lost so hopelessly in the vast Atlantic." He's right. That's what Cook said to himself. He's right. They always say the darkest hours before the dawn. The intervention forestalled any suicide bid. And that same day, the survivors heard two aircraft fly overhead at great altitude. Finally, on May 7th, 1943, they were spotted and rescued by the crew of a British warship, the HMS Rapid. Tragically, Armitage died soon after leaving Kenneth Cook, the sole survivor of the SS Lulworth Hill. After that, he lived away from the sea, working as a gamekeeper in Yorkshire. He would sometimes have nightmares that he was back on that raft and would wake up screaming. He published his account of the horrors he had been through 17 years after the ordeal ended. He felt he had come to know those men on the raft in a way that very few could understand. He had admired their courage, their endurance. He had seen the worst in them and in himself. The craven fear, the hysterical grasping at life. But Arnold had been the best of them. Wrote Cook, "I know that John's example and his presence saved and altered my life." I hope you enjoy these stories. Let's take a break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Class is now in session, and the UPS store is here to help you ace arriving on campus. Our certified packing experts can pack everything you need, from desktops to decor. Plus, when you pack and ship with us, you get our exclusive pack and ship guarantee. Your items arrive safe or your money back. Restrictions and limitations apply. To get a 20% off packing coupon and for full details, visit theupsstore.com/packing.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives.
Wow.
You know, I love this subject matter. The Third Man Effect, yes. The Guardian Angels. I love it because there's so many stories of people in dire situations where they feel like a loved one or Jesus or whoever it is, somebody is helping them get through it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the biggest question. Is it, in fact, a past loved one? Is it your guardian angel, or is it just something that's deep inside all of us? And it's your conscience. Like your brain knows when you're in trouble and it flicks that on and it allows you to power through whatever the situation may be. Or, you know, a guiding force like, hey, you better stop. And then they stop and then there's a wreck just up the head. And if you hadn't listened to that inside voice, you might have been killed. Like
it's like it's so your many, instincts
yeah.
is what it is. And they always tell you to listen to it. If you get a gut feeling, always listen to that gut feeling.
How many times have you done that and you're like, thank God I listened to myself. Otherwise, something bad would have happened, or I would have made that mistake, or I would have sold that. I'm glad I didn't, because now it's worth five times more. Like, you know, there's so many of those coincidences that happen, and that's one of the things about this show is when you start looking into all this, is it really coincidences? Is there something else going on? Is it the multiverse? You know, and the reason you know not to do that or this is because your other self in another multiple universe did do that. And so somehow your conscience is able to warn you like, no, don't do that or this will happen. It's just... I know you don't have any answers, but it's just a fascinating topic.
It is.
And I love those stories. And there's so many books with so many different stories. It's really cool.
I like the fact of like when people say they hear the voice.
Yeah.
Like it's not like you get a feeling or like you legitimately hear something say, you know, like watch out.
Yeah. And people have, you know, like in so many of the stories, they felt the presence. They felt like somebody's there, or they've even seen like a shadow person there. Or
man,
they didn't physically touch the presence, but they saw it, they felt it, they knew it was there, they were aware of it, and then it kind of goes away, and then the next thing you know, like a search and rescue squad finds you, and if they hadn't have found you, you would have froze to death.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
But that voice tells you to keep going, you know, not to give up and die. But then other people, say the people that do perish, like there's still frozen bodies on Mount Everest today. Did they have this unseen assistant help them and they ignored it? Or does not everybody get that gift?
Well, that's true. That's a good question.
Or maybe like we talk about mediums and stuff, that some people are perceptive, and those that are perceptive, they hear the voice and others don't.
Yeah.
Or does ego get in the way and other people are like, nah, man, I'm not listening to that.
I still, like we've discussed with everybody, you know, and we always bring it up. There are people in this world that seem to be tuned to a different frequency than other people, right? Like, I think everybody has a specialty or has something that they are tuned in or in vibe with without realizing it.
I agree.
You know what I'm saying? Like, everybody, and then there's some people, like, we know one, a couple personally, that all the weird stuff seems to not only happen around them, it may just be because it's something that they take notice of or that happens more in their presence because of their whatever abilities or whatever it is, their tuning, if you will.
Yeah.
Brett, I got something here I got to share with y'all before we get out of here. Lon fired this off because he knows how much I love it. There has been some more not deer sightings. This time, a couple of reports come in from Roanoke, Virginia.
Really?
Yeah. Listen, it says, I stayed after school one late December afternoon in 2022, just a few months ago, in Roanoke, Virginia, in the area there, for a basketball game. And after the game, I walked to the nearby church lot waiting for my dad. It was already dark. So as I stood waiting, I felt like someone or something was watching me. I turned around and saw the shadow of a man behind a bush. So I instantly ran to the other side of the street, caught my breath, and slowly walked back to the other side of the church. I would be able to see my dad drive up. I guess I'd probably get a better look, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it says, as I stood there, keeping an eye out for my dad and for the other shadows, I saw two deer along the edge of the woods. I put some space between me and the deer and watched the deer as they began to move around. I watched closely as one of them seemed to have a bad back leg or maybe was injured. I began to walk in the direction of the deer in order to get a better look. And when I came to within about 20 foot or so, I stopped. I was literally frozen and terrified at the same time. I realized that these were not deer. They both had oddly shaped heads with patches of hair that seemed to be stitched onto their bodies. It actually looked like human skin was underneath the patches. Then both deer looked in my direction, slowly stood up on their back legs. They then started to run in my direction, chasing me back to the church lot. I was yelling and running at the same time, so loud that my dad heard me a block away. I ran towards my home neighborhood, but my dad had happened to see me and caught up. As he stopped ahead of me, I jumped into the passenger seat, yelling, "Go, go!" He asked me what the hell I was yelling and running for. I couldn't even answer him. I was absolutely freaked out. The 10-minute drive home was surreal as I was thinking about what I'd experienced and what I was going to tell my dad. When we got home and after I'd calmed down a bit, my mom and dad sat at the dining room table with me and listened to my description of the encounter. They actually listened. They knew by my demeanor that something had really occurred. Later that night, while I was in my room watching TV, my dad came into my room and wanted to talk. And he told me about an encounter that he had had several years previously with a deer while he and my uncle were hunting in the nearby mountains. His description was very much like mine. He had told my mom about it at the same time. So now I know why they didn't question my sanity when we talked. Can you tell me what I encountered that day? I see references for wendigos and not deer when I started to search on Google. Is that what I witnessed? Is that what my dad witnessed also? Thanks. T.
Mm.
So we know. Now, look, there has been a few encounters in the Appalachian Mountain area, right?
Yes.
All up in that area. And I believe that's where it's like some of a lot of the original ones, I think even originated up in that area too.
There and a lot for some reason in Alberta.
Yeah. Oh, that is true. Yep. A bunch of them up in that area. So there's a few more. These actually got close. It looks like stitched hair on top of human skin. And then they stood up and started running.
Yeah, so
what's the benefit of looking like a deer, though? I understand if it was like deer and they were breaking into your house, like all the deer and all these housing additions that we see around here, right? If you were a not deer, you could slip over to somebody's house and then stand up, run in their garage, grab something you needed, and then pretend to be a not deer holding a weed whacker or something, I guess. I don't know. But what I'm saying is, what's the benefit?
Well, that's why people are saying that the not deer is actually a skinwalker or it's a wendigo, that it's not, you know— It's the not deer is what that is. I don't know that there's a benefit. I don't know what people are seeing, but
because I guess like I'm saying, and I know, like you said, I know you don't know, but seeing the deer along the tree line and then moving in towards them and them to be not deer, them to be some kind of abnormality. What was the point of those things being an abnormality?
I don't know.
Like, were they just moving some? Like I said, it causes so many questions before, or were they just out and about for a night of wendigo stroll? And then when they saw somebody like, oh, well, we'll get to feed on this negative energy. This will be fun. Let's go scare the crap out of them.
Man, I wish I had
it's
answers.
It's so weird.
It is weird.
The not deer are, look, Glimmer Man, not deer, Faye. Those are some of my favorite stories.
Me too. Me too. And speaking of stories, if you have any stories you want to share with me and Cam and the listeners, yeah, do not hesitate. Email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 888-393-2783. That's 888-393-2783. Let's not forget about our sponsors. HelloFresh. Go to HelloFresh.com/expanded65 and use the promo code expanded65 for 65% off plus free shipping. And don't forget about Lumi Labs. Just go to microdose.com, use the promo code expanded to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Cam, what do you got planned for the rest of your week?
Man, I think I'm going to leave it open and just see how it goes. I just got normal stuff that I've had planned. Just keep grinding along. I do have to go back for my checkup.
I got you.
Back for my checkup, see how my grill's working now and what they think about all of it, how it's healing up. But other than that, that's it.
Awesome.
I don't have any major plans for anything. What about yourself? You just working?
Me and Luke and the wife are going to Trader's Village, and we're going to check that out, so I'm sure we're going to have fun.
Yes.
Well, that's about all the time we have for this episode. I hope everybody out there has a good week. Till next time, I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.